Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers,
and from the law firm of Primer, Piper, Eggleston, and Kramer, providing comprehensive legal counsel to New Hampshire businesses and their owners for more than 30 years. For more information or to speak to an attorney, visit primer.com. And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own-farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Scientists are still celebrating and pondering the release last month of the first picture ever of a black hole. The image was taken by 8 telescopes on 4 continents, working in concert to create this one fabulous shot and ushering in what some called a new era of astrophysics. Today in The Exchange, our astronomy crew is here, and they're pretty excited about this. We'll find out why and cover other topics in space science, including one that has many people less than excited: predictions that large asteroids will approach Earth a little too close for comfort several times over the next decade. Let's get you into our conversation. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are Mal Cameron, retired astronomy and space educator at the McAuliffe Shepard Discovery Center. Mal, great to see you. Thank you for being here.
Great to be here.
Also with us, John Gianforte, astronomy instructor and UNH Observatory Director, co-founder of the Astronomical Society of Northern New England. John, welcome back. Always nice to see you.
Great to be here.
Also with us, Nicole Gallucci, assistant professor of physics and astronomy at St. Anselm College. Nicole, thank you very much, and good to see you as well.
Good to see you too.
Well, all of you, let's start with that black hole story.
Black hole sun, won't you come and wash me?
Sorry, we couldn't resist. That's from Soundgarden, Black Hole Sun. And Nicole, a new era in astrophysics. That's how big a deal many scientists thought this picture was of the black hole. What do you think? How important is this?
So I literally screamed when I saw the picture pop up during the whole press release thing at NSF. It's really exciting. Now, me being an instrumentation tech geek, I'm super excited about how they did it. But it's also super exciting that it's further confirmation of these supermassive black holes in the center of galaxies, and further confirmation of Einstein's ideas about general relativity and the calculations that came out of that, saying what it should look like around a black hole. I mean, it's pretty spot on to what has been simulated and modeled based on theory.
Well, and just give us your best description, Nicole, of a black hole. How do you explain it to your college students?
Yeah, so a black hole is a really, really, really dense region of space. Because it's so dense, the gravity around it is so strong that once you get too close to it, you can't pull away and escape from it. Even light, the fastest thing we know, can't escape from a certain distance around a black hole. It's one of the weirdest things we can imagine, but actually it's the least weird thing physics can come up with to explain what we see in these really dense regions of space.
Well, and of course, there's been a lot of pop culture playing with the idea of black holes and that incredible gravity that just kind of sucks you up. And as you said, Nicole, there's nothing you can do about it. Let's hear a little bit from the TV show The Simpsons.
A mini black hole. Whee! Oh, no. I gotta take it away before more clueless kids fall into it.
Geronimo!
Okay, so Lisa Simpson trying to save the world from getting sucked into black holes. How would you describe black holes, John Gianforte, to a fourth grader?
Oh, well, a fourth grader. That's easy. It's a place in space where the gravity is so strong that even light is too slow to get away from it. If you launch a rocket from Earth, it has to be going 7 miles every second to escape Earth's gravity. But if you lived on a black hole, you'd have to launch a rocket that traveled at the speed of light to get away. And Albert Einstein taught us that nothing can travel at the speed of light. So you're stuck. So black holes don't suck. They don't go looking for planets to suck up. But if you get too close to a black hole, its gravity will attract you to the point where you can't get away.
So they're not interstellar vacuum cleaners,
no,
but don't get too close.
They're not. They're not. And that's the big thing, right? Because you're just the very phrase black hole, whoever's writing or showing the video wants you to be afraid of them. You know, so there are 300 million, you know, black holes in the Milky Way galaxy. But the galaxy is so big, they're very rare. They're not everywhere.
Oh, 300 million sounds like a lot, John.
It is, but the galaxy is huge in terms of its volume. There's so much space in the volume of our galaxy. And black holes aren't these things that are roaming around looking for planets with life so they can go and make and ruin everyone's day. Black holes really don't do that.
How did you used to describe it, Mal, when you were at the McCullough-Shepard Discovery Center?
Funny you should ask. It was pretty similar to what John was saying. That I think I found when I was at the Discovery Center that these third and fourth graders who had come to visit us were very smart. And I'm sure they continued to be very smart. And they had a general idea of what a black hole was, but they wanted to hear more stuff. At the time, we were even running a show called Black Holes. And one of the terms that they would use in there was a very complicated and scientific term called spaghettification. And they got the biggest kick out of that because the idea was that if you were jumping into a black hole, that your feet, if you're going feet first into this black hole, your feet would be closer to the black hole than your head. So the closer you got, your feet would want to go faster and faster than your rest of your body, and eventually you would get stretched out like a big piece of spaghetti. So that's the term spaghettification.
He just wanted to say that word.
That's all.
It's an amazing word.
What was your reaction, Mal, to this photo?
Well, along with everybody else, it's pretty exciting because it's the first time we actually had a picture of a real black hole. Everything else you've ever seen are illustrations up to this point. And one of the things that's great about this is that it kind of confirmed what those pictures were representing. But now we've seen it up close and we know how to do it. But as Nicole was saying, this is not easy to do. We have to create, in order to see this, you have to have a telescope, essentially a radio telescope in this case, that is as big as the Earth to collect all this light. And there is a technique that probably Nicole wants to talk about, but because she's jumping away.
Well, it is really cool how they took this picture. You're right, Mal. And nobody, Nicole, has a telescope as big as the one that Mal described. So scientists used 8 telescopes on 4 continents to kind of all join hands. And that's the other part about this story that I love, is people, you know, all around the globe basically cooperating, coming together to do this. So go ahead.
Yeah. So I'm particularly excited about this, and I'm wearing my MIT Haystack Observatory T-shirt today, because when I was a summer student intern in 2003, they were talking about this and how they wanted to do this. And so to see it, you know, come to that image all this time later, super exciting. And it's a technique called very long baseline interferometry. It involves using telescopes that are widely spread apart and connecting them up to make one big telescope. Now, interferometry, if you picture in your head the Very Large Array in New Mexico, it's that Y-shaped array in the desert that was in Contact and one of, was it James Bond movie? No.
No, that was
I'm thinking of Arecibo.
That was GoldenEye.
Right, okay.
That was Arecibo.
Which telescope was in which pop culture? So that is an example of interferometry where all the telescopes are at one location. This technique uses telescopes, you know, spread across different continents. And what you get from that is really good resolution. So they were able to get resolution on the micro arc second scale, which may not mean anything to most people. The comparison was it's about the size of a small orange on the moon is the fine level of detail that they had to see. And there's actually an array of identical telescopes, 10 identical telescopes that's used for this. And that's what I've used before. But those telescopes weren't right for doing this. They had to use a frequency that these telescopes didn't work super well at. So they had to combine the efforts of these very different millimeter and submillimeter wave telescopes around the globe. So part of this effort was coordinating the telescopes. You have to calibrate each one differently because each one's a whole different beast. Even the identical telescopes, let me tell you, they each have their own personality. They each calibrate a little differently. These are very different telescopes. They had to figure out how to get the timing. You need to know a few things in interferometry. You need to know where you are. You need to know what time it is. And you need to know what direction you're pointing. And so getting those to super, super, super fine accuracy was a big part of this process.
Across
this
eight telescopes.
Across eight telescopes.
And huge teams of people.
Four continents.
I mean, yeah. It really is amazing. And I was reading, you know, some of the commentary from people who worked on this project. And more than one person said, yeah, I was sleeping 2-3 hours a night. I mean, it was just so much data. We actually have an email that asks a very good question about this that I want to share with all of you. And then I have another question about other black holes that you mentioned, John, in our Milky Way. Michael sent us an email to ask, what is the portion of the electromagnetic spectrum that's being visualized? And is this a visualization of the manipulation of that energy around the black hole, right, and not of anything being emitted from the black hole itself? He also asks, would an array of space-based telescopes alleviate the weather concern that delayed the measurements? That's a good question too, Michael. But to that first point that he makes, I think I understand it right, John Gianforte. Are we seeing the actual thing, or are we seeing sort of a manipulation of the light around it?
So black holes, by definition, don't emit any radiation. Now, the electromagnetic energy spectrum contains radiation from gamma rays, really powerful, energetic, stay away from kind of powerful, to radio waves. The wavelength that was received by these radio telescopes was 1.3 millimeters. So the wavelength, consider these radio waves very, very short wavelengths for radio waves, but long wavelengths in terms of the whole electromagnetic energy spectrum. So that's the part of the electromagnetic energy spectrum that these radio telescopes were observing in. But it's not like the black hole itself was emitting these radio waves.
Gotcha.
Because radio waves are simply another wavelength or frequency of radiation, and nothing escapes a black hole. But this image was created from radiation from immediately around the black hole, so that we could see the shadow of the black hole and we could see the effect of the black hole, making it very difficult for the light from the area to get to us.
Okay.
Okay. So black holes are really complicated, and they warp space because the gravity is so strong, and that's why light can't escape from the black hole's surface. And it's the image actually shows us that.
Well, what about his other question, Mal? Would we have gotten better pictures from, or less complicated pictures, interference from weather and so forth, with space telescopes? That's a great question, Michael. Thank you.
I would think we would get a similar picture, but he's right in that they had to wait for several opportunities. The actual picture taking, if you will, was done in 2017. So it took a while to collect the data from all the individual telescopes and bring it together. But they had to wait for a day that the weather was clear at every single point on the Earth where the telescopes are in order to be effective. So sure, if we could go up into space and have a wide array of radio telescopes out there in position that is makes the thing as big as the Earth, the interferometry approach, as Nicole said, that would work. But
so the one of the things about a space-based radio telescope array is the longer the baseline between the telescopes, the higher the resolution, the smaller a thing you can image, right? So the resolution that this telescope provided was 20 micro arc seconds. Now, an arc second is 1/3600th
wow.
of a degree. and there's 300.
That sounds really small.
There's 360 degrees in a circle. So you can imagine 1 degree is really, really, really small angle. But an arc second is 1/3600th of 1 degree. And the resolution that having this big baseline in over four continents was 20 millionths of an arc second. So it's like reading a newspaper in New York City from Paris. That was one of the analogies that I saw.
That is a great analogy, and it gives you a sense of just how powerful this technique is of getting these eight telescopes on four continents. Go ahead, Nicole.
Oh, I was actually, one of the reasons I was holding up my finger, if you hold up your index finger at arm's length, and I make everyone in my class do this, so I expect all of you listening to do this unless you're driving. The width of your index finger at arm's length is about the size of a degree on the sky. So we use this in our night labs, you know, just getting people around the sky. So the arc second is, 1/3600th of the width of your finger, and a micro arc second is
A millionth of that.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. It's super tiny. Space-based VLBI has been done before. Although you don't have to deal with the atmosphere, and water will mess you up at these wavelengths. It's going to mess up your calibration. And you get away from all of that. But also, I've never used this, the space VLBI telescopes before, but I've seen the data with people using it, and I think it's harder to place the exact location of it. Because you need that time, that location, and where it's pointing. And that is a little bit trickier to get when it's in space. But I think it also hasn't been explored nearly that much.
Well, I want to play a clip from somebody who worked on this project. And again, there were hundreds of people who worked on this. This relates, though, to what you said earlier, John, about there are 300 million black holes just in our own local Milky Way galaxy. Let's hear a little bit from Katie Bowman. She's a professor at Caltech. This is from a Washington Post video on other black holes closer than the one that was photographed.
We believe that there's a black hole at the center of our own Milky Way galaxy. And this black hole is called Sagittarius A star, or Sag A star for short. And we know that it's there because people have actually seen stars zipping around the black hole. So if we're able to reconstruct an image from Sagittarius A star, that is also a great test of general relativity and stronger, really, than what we've seen so far, because there's more degrees of freedom in the black hole that we've looked at. But that's for the future.
Again, that's Katie Bowman, professor at Caltech, talking about what John mentioned earlier, that there are lots of other black holes out there that we don't have beautiful pictures of.
Yes.
But playing that clip reminds me, Nicole, of something I know you want to talk about, that Katie Bowman kind of, I don't know, how do you put it?
Katie Bowman ended up in the middle of a viral storm.
There you go. That's the way to put it.
So like you said, and like they actually, what I really like about the press conference is they made everybody who was involved in the room stand up, and there's like 200-something people. Katie Bowman, a picture of her went viral, partly due to the institution she worked for making it go viral, partly due to, I think, other social factors at play. And so she ended up getting treated either as a hero or a villain, depending on who you are.
Well, we'll pick up that thread after a short break, and then we will turn to another big story that I want to cover with all of you, and that has to do with predictions that there could be some large asteroids in Earth's neighborhood coming too close to comfort in the next decade or so. And NASA has a whole program it wants to kick off called Asteroid Deflection. So we'll talk about that. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
¶¶ gift to NHPR through your estate plan is a wonderful legacy to leave for those who will need a trusted source for news. Hi, I'm Sarah Alger, Director of Major and Planned Gifts for NHPR. As NHPR has inspired you to learn more about your state and your world, so too will your legacy gift inspire future generations. Email me at salger@nhpr.org to learn more about including NHPR in your estate plans, or go to nhpr.giveplans.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, our astronomy crew is here, and we're talking about how to keep asteroids from hitting the Earth. We'll talk about that in a moment. Also, we'll hear new details about NASA's Moon to Mars mission. But for just a few minutes more, we've been talking about all the excitement around the first ever picture of a black hole recently. And we'd love to hear from you. Send us your emails, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. You can also use Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Our astronomy crew includes Mal Cameron, retired astronomy and space educator at the McAuliffe Shepard Discovery Center, John Gianforte, astronomy instructor, UNH Observatory director, co-founder of the Astronomical Society of Northern New England, and Nicole Gallucci, assistant professor of physics and astronomy at St. Anselm College. And Nicole, just before the break, you were talking about Katie Bowman. She's a professor at Caltech. We heard a little clip of her talking about black holes. She was part of this huge international team that worked on getting this fantastic picture of the black hole. And you said she kind of got caught up in an internet storm over one picture of her reacting to this amazing photo that went viral.
Yeah, so all the internet space nerds were on the internet the morning that this news broke because we wanted to see what was going on. And so watching this unfold over the day and the next few days was interesting because it's a human story in science that a lot of us have to deal with in our everyday lives. We can't just do black holes all day. So one of the institutes she worked with at MIT tweeted a highlight of what she had done. And this is something institutions usually do, right? If, you know, one of your own is involved in this 200-person collaboration, you're going to highlight that
sure.
when this news comes out. What happened, and I don't know if it's going to take an internet historian to trace how these things go viral, but she became memeified, sort of. And the one take of it was that she was a brilliant woman in STEM who had been overlooked, which was one of the messages that went around. And the other one, which was kind of the hero side. The other side, the villain side, painted her as this woman who was trying to take all the credit for this huge collaboration. And it was like, it's neither, it's somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, exactly.
And she handled it super well. Like, I would have a nervous breakdown if the internet.
Yeah.
If
she was treated pretty poorly.
She was treated very poorly. So it's an interesting watch of how things go viral. And part of it, I think, is because we are dealing in an era of Me Too and Me Too STEM where stories of women getting harassed or bullied in science are in the news. We hear it from our colleagues, not in the news. So we wanted to see something positive on the other side, watching a woman do something awesome. But it also, there's an underlying narrative of the lone genius in science that I think helped drive this. We're really attracted to that idea of this one person who came up with this great idea. We don't quite grok the 200 people that went into this thing. So I think that was part of the narrative, too. She's obviously doing a great job of communicating this science, which is something that I love. But I think it's interesting to take a step back and see how this all played out and how all of our biases play into it.
Well, and it's interesting, the team effort. And you're right, we're all sort of looking for an Einstein to talk about. But I watched the Apollo 11 movie recently, Mal, and you really get a sense watching that documentary. All the attention is on those three guys that went up there, especially the two that got to go down. But in the documentary, you see these giant, giant rooms of people all kind of making it happen. So I appreciate what you're saying, Nicole. It does reflect this other side of these giant teams that work on these. And then, you know, maybe the human brain just likes to latch onto one face. I just wonder what you think, Mal.
I saw that movie.
Yeah.
And it was wonderful because of course, this is the 50th anniversary this year in July of the Apollo landing, Apollo 11 on the moon, which was a great achievement considering what the technology was. And I know we're going to be talking later about the moon to Mars type thing.
Definitely.
And I think as a result of all the Apollo things, I believe a lot of people in the general public kind of think, well, yeah, we've done that before. It's going to be easy. Next month, let's send somebody to the moon. We can do it. It's not that easy. And technology has changed and stuff. We'll talk about that later, I guess. But yeah, it was exciting to watch that movie and see all the people that were involved, thousands of people involved in getting us to the moon, and with very crude spacecraft compared to what's now being offered even by non-NASA places like SpaceX, and there's Blue Origin and so on that are building spacecraft that will bring us up at least into orbit. And possibly later, I know Elon Musk wants to get his SpaceX people going right to Mars at some point, too. So
it's a long trip,
it's
which
a
we
long
will talk
trip.
About.
Yes, we will.
One more question, though, on the black holes. And then I do want to move on quickly to asteroid deflection before we get to moon to Mars. Otto sent us an email when this happened. And I think he's talking about the big picture that we've been talking about. Otto says, my brother and I were talking about how light was bent around the black hole. Wondered if your guests have any thoughts on the idea that the light bent around the black hole could be moving faster because of the slingshot sequence effect. Is this something that the new data could be used to research? Otto, awesome question. And John, I'm going to turn to you because you described earlier how this works.
Sure.
And how the picture itself works.
So the word slingshot and the words slingshot and gravity are used when we use the gravity of a planet to alter the path or the trajectory of a spacecraft. Without using fuel, you can use the gravity of a planet to help deflect the spacecraft's path. But when you have a black hole, the gravitational field around the black hole is immensely powerful, so powerful that it warps the fabric of space-time, which is a term that Einstein gave us, and caused us to think differently about how gravity and the universe work from his general relativity theory that was published in 1915. So it's not going to make the light travel any faster. If anything, it's going to suck energy out of the light. It's going to make it more difficult for the light to escape the gravity near the black hole, and that's what distorts the light. It actually makes it difficult for the light to move away from the black hole, even if it's not trapped within the event horizon of the black hole. The event horizon is like the surface of the black hole. So the strong gravity of the black hole does affect the environment near the black hole, and it has a tendency to warp space. And light is basically a stream of photons, little packets of light energy, that follow the curvature of space. And that's how gravity bends light.
Well, Otto, it's a great question. And John, it's complicated, so great job explaining it. I want to turn to another topic that caught my attention over the last couple of weeks, and that's asteroids coming too close for comfort. Just last week, as I'm sure you all know, there was a planetary defense conference. Scientists were talking about defending the planet from these asteroids coming into Earth's neighborhood. I want to play a little clip from NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine. Here he is talking to reporters about the significance of NASA paying attention to this asteroid deflection.
The reason it's important for NASA to take this seriously is something you called the giggle factor. We have to make sure that people understand that this is not about Hollywood. It's not about movies. This is about ultimately protecting the only planet we know right now to host life, and that is the planet Earth.
And all of you, I was pretty struck just by the fact, John, you first, but anybody jump in, that we even had a planetary defense conference. This seems like they're taking it pretty seriously.
Well, they are. And this is not, this past April is not the first time that organizations in the United States have met to discuss defending the planet against impacts. So I'll do it pretty simply. You've looked at the moon, either with the naked eye or with binoculars or a telescope, and you know that it's covered with craters.
Sure.
Every one of those large craters on the moon is a result of an impact, something crashing into the moon's surface over the past 4 billion years. So there's a lot of accumulated marks on the moon from impacts. Well, the Earth is almost four times bigger than the moon,
and its gravity is much stronger. So the Earth has actually been impacted many more times than the moon has. It's a bigger target, and its gravity can pull more objects into it than the moon can because of its weaker gravity. So just because over the last 1,000 or 10,000 years there have been no major impacts, which, by the way, is a very short span of time in the history of the solar system, doesn't mean they don't happen anymore. So more than 1,000 tons of infalling material fall to Earth every single day. So the Earth is peppered by small impacts all the time.
These ones are predicted to be big, though,
right,
John, and coming very close. So, Nicole, how unusual is that for these big pieces to come pretty close?
You're calling it big, and I think it's big on a human scale. It's itty-bitty on rocks in space scale. So the universe is trying to kill us all the time in many, many ways. Asteroids are probably the most likely way that the universe is going to kill us, other than, you know, putting yourself in space without a spacesuit. I lost my train of thought.
Well, just that these are really big.
Yes.
And that they're around all the time.
Right.
And that it's not that unusual for them to come.
Yeah, and
close by.
So a lot of the craters that we see on the moon are old, from a time when things were getting bombarded a lot more. So there's less bombardment than there was in the early universe, but all it takes is one of what astronomers consider to be a small rock to cause huge havoc for humans. We're kind of fragile creatures and won't do so well if a large object hits us, causes a huge crater in a metropolitan center, throws dust into the atmosphere, lowering the temperature well beyond where we'd like it to be, and doing all these nasty things.
What's NASA's plan for asteroid deflection, Mal? I mean, how do you deflect an asteroid? And in the movies, don't they just blow them up?
Sure. Well, we need to get Bruce Willis involved first.
Yeah, right.
I was hoping you wouldn't mention him.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I love to hate that movie.
Everybody does.
But, well, the concept is, and they've been toying with this for a while, and there are some plans. SpaceX is even getting involved with a deflection mission.
So does that mean you nudge it aside?
Yes. The idea is, first of all, to identify these very big rocks. And from our point of view, very big, as Nicole was saying, they're not the size of a full-size asteroid. Hopefully not. But the idea is to identify them and trace their orbits and figure out if there a chance this is going to come and hit the Earth at a certain time, and enough in advance so that we can send some rocket ship up there, a heavy-duty, massive, something with a lot of mass to it, to actually crash into that oncoming asteroid and be able to change its path.
So bump it aside,
the Earth,
not blow
bump
it up.
Bump it aside.
Yeah. Is that feasible, Mal, or is that just Hollywood stuff?
I think it's feasible that it could work, but you need a lot of power to do it, depending on the size of the mass of the actual asteroid itself. But another way to do it, in the movies, the idea was to try to split it in half. And someone even suggested a nuclear bomb to blow it apart, but all you can see is millions of pieces.
Radioactive
pieces coming back to Earth. So the scenario they did with the Planetary Defense Conference was interesting because, I'm claiming that I learned this from NPR News, but they were giving a wrap-up of it, and they said the ultimate idea was to have a scenario totally fake. People were reading about it and said, in fact, somebody asked me the other day, says, are we going to get hit by an asteroid in the 2020s or something?
That's the prediction. Said, or not that we'll get hit, but that they'll come close.
But this scenario said 2027.
Yes.
And the idea was, okay, we've got time to plan on this. We've got about 8 years to get something up there and see what we can do. And so the scenario plays out that what happened was they hit this asteroid with multiple whatever, and it split the asteroid into two pieces. So it deflected it away from coming down in the center part of our country in Idaho somewhere. And instead, one piece missed us and the other piece blew away in Manhattan. So
blowing it up is not a good idea.
Not a good idea.
Nudging it is a better idea.
They, always go after my hometown. Always go after New York City.
John, NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine said recently he wants international help with this. He basically said this is too big a job for the U.S. to do alone. What do you think?
Yeah, it's a worldwide problem. It's not a problem for any one nation. The more people looking, the problem is to discover asteroids so we can track them. All the asteroids that are bigger than, say, 100 meters across. NASA considers an asteroid to be potentially hazardous if it's more than about 100 meters across and it can come within about 4.6 million miles of the Earth. Now, because gravity of planets and other asteroids, the orbits of asteroids change a little bit. So every time they go around the sun, just because an asteroid misses us this time around, it could come closer or further away the next time.
Oh, excuse me for interrupting. So if it flies by and doesn't hit us, John, that doesn't mean we're out of the park. We're all good.
Right, because the asteroids orbit the sun just like the Earth.
Gotcha.
And so we have to be vigilant. We have to, let's find all the asteroids that have somehow migrated out of the asteroid belt. That's between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter. And thousands of them have done that. Most of them are small, but some of them are, you know, a few hundred meters across. Some of them are larger. But the big ones are rare, and they're easier to spot. But the more countries with programs to find, discover, track, and catalog, calculate the orbits, so far we know of no asteroid that has Earth's number on it. But you can go to the spaceweather.com website, a very reliable scientific website. At the bottom of the page, it tells you that there are, I checked this yesterday morning, there are approximately 1,983 potentially hazardous asteroids that we know about it. Several months ago, that number was 1,967. So we keep adding to that list, and that's a good thing because now we know of more and we can keep track of them. And what we want is a lot of notice when we find one that we think will impact us, because then we'll have lots of time to develop strategies, which there are many that scientists are thinking of. In fact, NASA has a mission called DART, called it's called the Double Asteroid Redirect Test.
Yes, I read about that.
So
that was a big conversation at this Planetary Defense Conference.
So they picked an asteroid that's about 530 feet across. It's called Didymos. And it actually has a moon. It's actually a double asteroid.
Wow, it's big enough to have a moon.
And they're gonna shoot the DART spacecraft at the smaller one. It's a binary asteroid. And that's a perfect target because we can affect the little one and use the pair, how they orbit each other, to see if what we did affected the trajectory of the asteroid.
Well, in a way, it's creepy that there are all these asteroids that are so close, as you say, John. But in a way, Nicole, it's great for your students because it gives them a chance to directly think about this and project how they might work on this.
Most people, when they hear an asteroid's going to come super close to Earth, they get, you know, like a little nervous, maybe.
They think we'll be like the dinosaurs.
Yeah. And, you know, space scientists get really excited because it means more data. So we're going to have a bunch of these asteroids come sort of close to the Earth starting in 2027 and ending with one you may have heard of called Apophis. And space scientists are really excited about this because in addition to the gravitational instabilities, the way that the sunlight heats up the asteroid can also change its motion slightly. And so they look at the spin and the motion of these when they come really close using radar.
All right. Coming up, we're going to turn to another topic that there has been a lot of press about, and that is NASA's big reveal of all the details about its moon to Mars mission. Yes, I know we've talked about this before, but now there's a budget. There's hard numbers on this. There was a big, big release just a couple weeks ago. So moon to Mars coming up, and more of your questions. Keep those emails coming. exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be right back.
I'm Jason Moon, host of the Bear Brook podcast from NHPR. Join me for a live show at the Wilbur Theater in Boston on Tuesday, May 14th. I'll speak about how we produced Bear Brook, the controversial science that helped crack open the case, and how that science is changing criminal investigations all across the country. Get your tickets now at thewilbur.com.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Exchange listeners, we'd love your input for a series on New Hampshire's labor shortage later this month. What do you think? What should be done to create a more robust workforce in the state? Let us know. Go to nhpr.org/exchange to submit your stories or questions, or you can always email us with your thoughts at exchange@nhpr.org. Again, later in May, we'll be working on a series on New Hampshire's labor shortages, and we'd love your input. Back to our conversation now with our astronomy crew, and we're turning now to NASA's big reveal of a bunch of details about its Moon to Mars mission. Let's hear from you two. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. So, all of you, NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine recently held this huge event presenting all sorts of details with what's called Space Policy Directive 1. This is from the president's budget, which he said was well-funded. And in a presentation to NASA employees, Bridenstine described this effort, Moon to Mars. We'll talk about the Mars part of this in a moment, but sticking with the moon for a sec, Mal, to you, why go back and spend more time on the moon? As you said earlier, we've been there.
Well, that's true. And I would like to see us go back, frankly, because there's a lot of moons still to be discovered and learned about. All during the Apollo program, for example, there were, six different people or eight. I've lost count. Who walked on the moon? I think it was a total of six.
12.
12. That's right. Thank you, John. That's right. But anyway, the total time of all the astronauts on the moon, when they spent 80 hours roaming around the moon, picking up moon rocks, and they brought back about a ton about 842 pounds of rocks they brought back from the, it was 11 to 17, but of course 13 never made it. And that's all we've had. It's like trying to land on the Earth and somebody lands in New York, somebody lands in Idaho or whatever, and they go back to their home planet and say, this is what the Earth is like.
Yeah,
it's all water.
Desert.
It's too crowded.
It's crowded, right. So there's still a lot to be learned about the moon. We know there's ice on the moon, the poles. They want to have a chance to get there and look at and see if they can manufacture different chemicals out of there. They can break down the ice, the H2O, and they can make hydrogen and oxygen to make fuel. They can have water to drink if they find it there, too. So there's lots of things to learn. But the bottom line was to make it a jumping-off point to learn about build stuff to get to Mars.
Well, let's hear a little bit from Administrator Bridenstine about, again, there's a lot we don't know about the moon.
Right. But it's also going to go to the poles of the moon. It can go to the north. It can go to the south, L1 and L2, giving landers, rovers, robots, and humans more access to more parts of the moon than ever before. We don't want to miss anything ever again. There's a lot to learn, and this is about sustainability.
And he went on to say sustainability means people hanging out up there, not just going down for a couple days and then coming back. What do you think about that, John? Hanging out on the moon, sustainability, being there for a while, living there, not just visiting.
There are some good reasons to go to the moon, to create astronomical observatories there, especially on the far side, to have a staging area. Mel put this very well. If we go to the South Pole, where we know there's water ice in craters that are deep and never see sunshine, we know there's ice there, and water is made out of hydrogen and oxygen, which just happens to be the fuel that we currently use for rockets. So let's say you want to eventually go to Mars. Wouldn't it be a nice idea if you had a source of rocket fuel a short distance away from the Earth? And it's much easier if you didn't have to transport all that fuel lifting out of Earth's gravity, which is expensive, and you need a much bigger gas tank to do that. But if you could manufacture on the moon and use that as the start of the mission, at least for some of the materials going to Mars, that saves money and saves energy in going to Mars.
Although you'd have to bring all the equipment to the moon
sure.
to process those materials into fuel, which sounds really expensive.
It would be
easier just to do it on Earth where, you know, the equipment already
Well, Earth has
exists.
A very deep gravity well. So it's hard to get equipment and fuel, especially, off the ground. So, yes, it would be done in small steps. We would make a little manufacturing plant on a small scale first, see how that went. If it went the way we expected, we could grow that. It could be done incrementally where it's done over a 10 or 20 or 50 year period of time so that we can use lunar soil, which has lots of important components to it, including oxygen, so that we could start manufacturing rocket fuel and ways to build houses and domiciles on the moon. It's quite possible. Not easy. Setting up camp in Antarctica wasn't easy either, but look at what we have there now.
Well, at this event where the administrator spoke, there were signs everywhere, posters and so forth, Nicole saying, moon to Mars, moon lights the way. How do you feel about this idea of the moon lighting the way to Mars? I think John is kind of explaining it, but I'd like your thoughts too.
It's a really great idea. What you can't see on the radio was my skeptical face during the audio clip you were playing, as we were discussing a little bit before the show. I think I'm a little jaded, which is sad because I'm not. I don't know. I was born in the era of the space shuttle. So all my life, people have been working and living in near-Earth orbit, but I've never seen a moon mission in my lifetime. I've never seen a human mission to the moon or Mars, but they've talked about it ever since I was a little kid. And when I was a little kid, they said, oh, your generation's going to be the one to go to Mars.
And here you are, an assistant professor, and
which is
we're
fine.
Not at Mars yet.
I being an astronaut sounds way too physically taxing for me, but... And then, you know, when I was in undergrad and grad school, it was this moon mission. And then when later in grad school, it was this asteroid mission. And these projects we're talking about are going to go beyond the scope of any one presidency, which seems to be the driving force.
If we said this, if they gave us, if the funding went with the directorate, would that make you feel better?
Yes, that would make me feel better. Long-term funding, too.
I worry about that, too. Show me the money.
Yeah,
right?
It's really hard.
When the next president takes office, that same policy can't be dissolved and a new one created. Otherwise,
which is what's been happening.
That's what we keep seeing. Each administration that comes in has different thoughts
about space. It has to be
long-term.
Have the goal, a stake in the sand, has to stay there, and we have to stay the course.
So, Nicole, feeling kind of cynical about this, we're going to Mars. Everybody buckle your seatbelts.
I want nothing more. Okay, a few things more. But one thing I really want is to see us become an interplanetary civilization. That would be so cool to see in my lifetime, even just the beginnings of it, even just setting up these scientific outposts. By the way, the backside of the moon, very good place to put a low-frequency radio telescope, which I would love to see. But I guess I am cynical because I've seen the direction change administrator after administrator, and I've seen, unfortunately, too closely now the way the funding mechanisms work. And so, yeah, I'll believe it when I see it a little further down the path.
Well, this administrator, Bridenstine, sounded pretty excited about recent discoveries on Mars made by the rovers that we've talked about over the past decade or so. And he seemed pretty excited about the possibility of humans checking those out. The idea that Mars, while maybe it wasn't inhabited, he said, there is strong evidence that it was habitable. Let's hear.
Now, I'm not talking about bunny rabbits. I want to be clear. I'm talking about microbial life. And I think it's important, and this budget funds our ability to reach out to another world and find potentially life on another world.
Okay, so there's Jim Bridenstine. What do you think, Mal?
I love the way he talks about the budget. And it sounds like NASA's getting a slew of money to do all this. And they're not really, when you look at the total budget of the United States, NASA's cut on that is less than 1% of that budget. It's like half of 1%, I believe. But there certainly has been exploration on Mars that have shown us that there was water on Mars years ago, millions of years perhaps. Mars has lost its atmosphere. We know a lot about Mars. We've been trying to study it more. We got more spacecraft around there now than we ever have. And there are more to come. But to send people to Mars is the big difference with them and robots is you got to feed them. You got to provide all those other things to keep somebody alive. And what happens if they get sick?
I was thinking that, sure.
You can't go rescue them. So you can kind of, I guess the idea is you can kind of practice doing this on something like the moon because the moon is just a couple of days away or so if something happened. But still you have to have a rocket set up to go and rescue somebody who's in trouble there.
Well, you have to have a doctor like they had in Star Trek, right? Who could just basically put this little thing
using
on you and
salt and pepper shakers.
You're all done.
You know, whatever. it's exciting to want to go to Mars. It's always been there. Someone once said that it's in our DNA to explore out beyond the Earth. We've explored pretty much everything on the surface of the Earth. There's no place to go but up and out into space.
Well, we've talked a lot this hour about the accomplishments or hopes of adults in space science. I want to focus on the young people for a moment. And we got a call over the weekend from someone who runs a nonprofit science and education program in Western New Hampshire for middle and high school girls called Young Women in Science and Engineering. This group received an invitation to the NASA SpaceX Crew Dragon launch at Kennedy Space Center after the students developed a proposal called Aerospace Engineering, Deep Space Ecology, and Carbon-Free Energy. Wow, sounds really cool. We heard a little bit from Jerry DeMero. He's board chair of Northern Heritage Mills, which runs the program.
The intent is to inspire young women to consider science and engineering. In particular, this year, we're having an aerospace science and engineering program. The reason why we have this program is that there's a real shortfall of women going into science and engineering. If we are considering space, the only way we're making energy in space at this point is solar cells.
Again, that's Jerry DeMero. He helps run the program. The girls were recognized for their work on solar energy. They did a class on solar lamps taught by a Dartmouth professor. Jerry, thank you for telling us about that. And Nicole, you've been working with high school students in Manchester.
Yeah, so I mentioned this in the show a while back. It's a project called Access Academy that's run out of the Amelia Center at St. Anselm College, where St. Anselm College students and faculty and staff give courses, after-school courses for Manchester High School students. So it's an after-school activity for the high school students. They also get a little bit of high school credit for doing it. So I didn't teach the course myself. I actually mentored four of our undergrads that are all science majors, and they taught the material to the students. I kind of hung around in the back and, like, fixed stuff when it broke. So they built a radio telescope, which is super awesome. It's a project.
They built it themselves.
I mean, we couldn't let them solder, apparently. We didn't have the right insurance for that. But, you know, it's fine. They got to see the soldering and the drilling. But most of it, they built themselves. It's called Radio Jove. It's a telescope kit you can get for a few hundred dollars that was developed as part of a NASA education program. It's essentially a big copper wire, or actually a pair of big copper wires. And with that, you can see it's called Radio Jove because it was designed to detect radio bursts from Jupiter. But it also detects solar bursts as well. So over the course of the semester, they learned a little bit about radio astronomy. And my students, the college students, learned about radio astronomy for the first time themselves, too.
As they were teaching these
students. Built this telescope. We put it out on our campus observatory. It fell down twice. We finally got it to stay up permanently. And like 2 days after it was out there, we actually caught a solar flare, which was cool because the sun's actually been really quiet lately until the last few weeks or so when we had our telescope up. And so they got to present the solar flare that they captured with a telescope that they built for the showcase, the Access Academy showcase on campus. So I'm really excited. Similar in scope to that other program, Access Academy covers a wide range of topics, from, you know, poetry to public speaking to college preparedness and to STEM. So the idea is to give these students a taste of something they wouldn't otherwise get in class, and kind of pique their interest for different subjects as they look to what they're going to do next.
Well, and how satisfying to build the equipment and then capture a solar flare.
I couldn't believe it. I could imagine every single way this thing could go wrong. And it worked out in the 10 weeks we were allotted. So it's pretty exciting.
Mal, what are you going to be looking forward to in the next couple weeks in terms of headlines from the world of space science?
Well, the next couple of weeks is a big one coming up from Mr. Bezos.
Right, on Thursday. He said he has a big announcement.
And,
you're right.
He's been teasing everybody with a look at the Shackleton picture at the South Pole. There's a picture of his boat, his ship, and it has something to do with that. And they're not sure what his announcement is going to be. But on May 9th is the big announcement is from his teaser. Jeff Bezos is going to announce something from about his Blue Origin series that he's going through. So I'm anxious to see what that's about.
I'm so glad you mentioned that, because we often talk about, when we talk about private space entities, we talk about Elon Musk, SpaceX, but Jeff Bezos, you're right, is also involved, and his team has been teasing that they're going to have something big on Thursday.
What's interesting, he also launches from West Texas, is what he's been doing some launch things from. It's not on the coasts or anything. So, I want to see what that's about.
Absolutely. How about you, John?
Well, I'm looking for Thursday, too. I'm kind of curious about what he's doing. He doesn't want to be in the shadow of Elon Musk. So I think they're kind of dueling each other, but we'll see. That's the big thing this week, anyway.
Yeah. How about you, Nicole?
I'm looking forward to submitting my grades, so I can
College is almost out.
Yeah, actually do some of the radio astronomy research I have tagged for the summer.
All right. Well, we'll talk to you again in the summer. There's a big meteor shower that happens at the end of the summer, so it'll be fun to catch up with you around that time. For now, though, we will close it out. Nicole, it was really nice to see you. Thank you for being
here. See you.
Congratulations on your students.
Thanks.
Capturing that solar flare. That's Nicole Gallucci, Assistant Professor of Physics and Astronomy at St. Anselm College. John Gianforte, thank you for helping us out. We really appreciate it.
Great to be here, Laura.
That's John Gianforte, astronomy instructor, UNH Observatory Director, and co-founder of the Astronomical Society of Northern New England. Mal, always a pleasure. Thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure, Laura.
That's Mal Cameron, retired astronomy and space educator at the McAuliffe Shepherd Discovery Center. And this is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.